Most people think reggae is about peace and love, but Burning Spear was never here to make you feel good. He was here to wake you up. Before Bob Marley became reggae's global face, Winston Rodney, better known as Burning Spear, was crafting something more dangerous. A sonic revolution forged in the fires of colonial trauma, African resistance, and Garveyite prophecy. Raised in the same Jamaican town as Marcus Garvey himself, Spear didn't just sing about black pride, he weaponized it. His music wasn't meant to entertain, it was meant to agitate, to remind, to resurrect. With chants like, "Do you remember the days of slavery?" he dared a colonized people to confront their forgotten pain. When corporate labels tried to soften his sound, he fought back and built his own. And while the world cheered Marley, Spear stayed militant, chanting down Babylon with fire in his lungs and Garvey in his soul. This is the untold story of a rebel prophet who turned music into memory and memory into a weapon. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. From St. Anne's Bay to the birth of a voice. In a quiet coastal parish called St. Anne's Bay, the kind of place where goats cross the road slower than time, something unexpected was born. Not once, but twice. First in 1887, Marcus Garvey, black nationalist, Pan-African prophet, and architect of global black consciousness. Then in 1945, Winston Rodney, a quiet farm boy who would grow into Burning Spear, the rebel prophet of reggae, Garvey's voice resurrected in rhythm. That two revolutionaries emerge from the same soil is no coincidence. St. Anne's Bay isn't just geography, it's spiritual ground, a place where ancestors whisper in the wind and history never fully sleeps. Winston Rodney was the youngest of nine children. His parents were people of the land, his father a farmer, his mother a domestic worker. They had little, but they had rhythm. The pulse of African survival, the hush of stories told under moonlight, the thunder of Niabingi drums carried over hillsides. Rodney didn't grow up with a guitar in hand. He grew up listening. Listening to Burning Spear is dangerous because he asks you to stop, to be still, to listen. To remember what the system erased from your soul. He doesn't offer comfort. He offers confrontation. And in an age of distraction, that might be the most subversive act of all. Sonia's final vow. Through it all, every tour, every album, every financial sacrifice, Sonia Rodney stood beside him. And in recent interviews, she's made it clear, burning music will never be absorbed. The catalog will remain unremixed. The fire will be protected. It is not just Winston's voice, she said. It is Garvey's ghost, and that is not for sale. When Winston Rodney leaves this earth, there will be no monument big enough, because his monument is the music, the sweat-soaked stage, the barefoot walk to the mic, the bass that shook the colonial lie, and the truth that followed. He didn't write songs. He wrote scripture for the soul. He didn't perform, he preached, and he didn't ask for applause. He asked for remembrance, because if you remember, truly remember, then maybe you'll finally act. Most people think reggae is just music. They think revolution is loud. They think prophets die with time. But Burning Spear proved otherwise. He taught us that memory is resistance, that sound is sacred, and that sometimes the quietest fires burn the longest. Winston Rodney was never trying to be a favorite artist. He was trying to be a wake-up call. And now, long after the industry forgot him, long after the charts moved on, his voice still echoes. Because truth doesn't retire, and prophets don't fade. They just wait until we're ready to hear them again. Silence. Listening to sermons. Listening for meaning in the music of life. But what broke the silence, what first reached him through a dusty radio dial, wasn't Jamaican. It was Black American soul, Curtis Mayfield, Otis Redding, James Brown, Their voices floated across the Caribbean Sea like coded messages. Messages that said, "You are not broken. You are not powerless. You are black. And that is sacred." Rodney listened, but he wanted more than rhythm. He wanted roots. Discovering the fire. Garvey's echo. While some boys found freedom in sports or mischief, young Winston found it in books, or more accurately, pamphlets. Those small, tattered publications passed hand to hand in rural Jamaica, banned from schools but thriving in backyards and Rasta camps. They bore the words of Marcus Garvey, a man who the British branded a troublemaker, but whose words stirred the hearts of the oppressed. "Up, you mighty race. Accomplish what you will." Garvey spoke of Africa not as a myth, but as home. Of self-reliance, not as a dream, but a duty. Of resistance, not as rebellion, but redemption. Rodney didn't just read Garvey. He absorbed him. As he matured, he found spiritual refuge in the Rastafari movement, which had long treated Garvey as a divine messenger. Among the Nyabingi drums, the Atal food, and the sacred smoke, Rodney began to understand his purpose. He wasn't meant to sing love songs. He wasn't meant to fit in. He was meant to chant down Babylon, Bob Marley, and the open door. In 1969, everything changed with a bicycle ride. Rodney heard that another son of St. Anne's Bay, Bob Marley, was working with a legendary producer in Kingston named Coxone Dodd, the founder of Studio One. If you were serious about music in Jamaica, Studio One was the temple. So Rodney pedaled to Kingston with one mission: get in. Accounts vary on exactly how he got through the door. Some say Marley introduced him personally. Others claim he waited for hours, asking anyone who'd listen. But the result was the same. He was given a chance. At Studio One, Rodney met two vocalists, Rupert Willington and Delroy Hines, who shared his spiritual fire. The trio became the first incarnation of Burning Spear, a name inspired by a Kenyan freedom fighter, Jomo Kenyatta, whose nickname reflected his fiery rhetoric and anti-colonial politics. Their first single was released that same year, "Door Peep, Shall Not Enter." Minimalist, ominous, a slow chant of spiritual warning. It wasn't catchy, it wasn't commercial, it was prophetic. The song whispered like smoke through Jamaica's hills. For those tuned to frequency of resistance, it was magnetic. Jack Ruby and the Black Disciples Burning Spear had arrived, but his sound was still raw. It would take another visionary to forge it into fire. That man was Lawrence Lindo, better known as Jack Ruby, a sound system operator from Ocho Rios, who understood that reggae wasn't just entertainment, it was revolution. Ruby wasn't flashy. He was focused. He believed in Garvey. He believed in roots. And he believed in Winston Rodney. Under Ruby's guidance, Spear didn't just record songs. He built scripture. Ruby recruited a group of musicians called the Black Disciples, whose militant, trance-inducing rhythms would become the foundation of a sonic uprising. Together, they recorded an album that would split reggae in two, Marcus Garvey, 1975. This wasn't music. This was a sermon, a warning, a return. The album forced listeners to remember the history they were taught to forget. Slavery days, the invasion, tradition. Every track was a spiritual dagger. Slow, heavy, relentless. It didn't ask you to dance. It demanded you listen. The war with Island Records. Burning Spear's voice echoed beyond Jamaica's borders. The global ears were listening. And soon Island Records, the label behind Bob Marley's global success, offered Spear a distribution deal. But there was a problem. The truth was too raw. Island remixed the album for international audiences. They slowed it down, softened the edge, removed the danger. They turned a Burning Spear into a butter knife. Rodney was furious. He hadn't crafted his sound for cocktail parties and college dorms. This was ancestral thunder, not entertainment. He refused to let it happen again. With his wife Sonia Rodney, he formed Burning Music Records, an independent label that would control all future releases. The music would no longer be filtered. The revolution would no longer be remixed. Beyond music, the mission. What Winston Rodney was building wasn't a career. It was a cultural counterattack. Burning Spear didn't perform. He ministered. His concerts weren't parties. They were revivals. No dancers. No glitz. Just a man, barefoot, eyes closed, sweat pouring down his face as he chanted truth into a world built on lies. While Marley sang, One Love, Spear intoned, Remember the days of slavery, and he meant it. Conclusion. The voice has been awakened by 1975. Burning Spear wasn't just a band. It was a force, a channel for everything Jamaica had tried to forget. The lash, the chain, the fire, and the soul that refused to break. Rodney wasn't just a singer. He was Garvey's echo. His voice cracked open a lie and poured truth into the wound. And in the hills of St. Anne's Bay, where barefoot children still chase goats and the sea hums ancient prayers, the fire he lit is still burning. Chapter 2, Garvey's Ghost and the Rise of a Movement. The Marcus Garvey album wasn't just a collection of songs. It was a lightning strike. It split the reggae world open and exposed what lay beneath the surface. A long-buried rage, a Pan-African truth, and a spiritual uprising that couldn't be silenced. And it made one thing undeniably clear. Burning Spear wasn't playing music. He was waging war on forgetting. The 1975 release arrived like a fist through glass. From the opening bars, Marcus Garvey felt like a requiem, a warning, and a battle cry all in one. Marcus Garvey's words come to pass. That wasn't a lyric, it was a prophecy. The sound of spiritual warfare. Jack Ruby's production on Marcus Garvey was raw, percussive, stripped down to its spiritual bones. No polished melodies, no commercial hooks, just bass, drums, and Rodney's thunderous voice, thick with ancestral gravity. Every track was designed to disrupt. Slavery Days wasn't nostalgic, it was accusatory. The invasion wasn't metaphor, it was historical indictment. Jordan River wasn't religious comfort, it was coded resistance. These weren't reggae's sunny beach tracks, these were exorcisms, calling out demons left behind by British rule, European religion, and plantation wealth. Rodney's voice carried pain, but also a sacred obligation to remind his people of what they survived and what they could become. Do you remember the days of slavery? He didn't ask it gently. He asked it like a man trying to break a spell. The remix that started a fire-burning Spears message wasn't easy to market. That's why when Island Records acquired the rights to distribute Marcus Garvey internationally, they did what corporations always do with dangerous truth. They watered it down. They slowed the tracks. They toned down the militant edge. They removed the urgency. To them, this wasn't sabotage. It was strategy. They wanted to make the music palatable to white European audiences. But to Winston Rodney, it was blasphemy. The reaction was instant, furious. Rodney didn't just object, he retaliated. He made a decision that would cost him mainstream fame, but preserve his soul. He walked away. Rodney and his wife Sonia formed Burning Music Records, an independent label that would never answer to foreign executives or PR teams. No more remixes, no more dilution, no more apology for the truth. From that moment on, Burning Spear became a sovereign entity. Marcus's ghost. The next revelation. Rodney's response wasn't just business. It was spiritual. The follow-up album, Marcus's Children, also known as Social Living, was both a continuation and an evolution. If Marcus Garvey was a roar, Marcus's Children was a firestorm. Tracks like Civilized Reggae, Marcus Say Ja No Dead, An Institution delivered even sharper commentary on colonial systems, police violence, and cultural brainwashing. Marcus say, Ja no dead, Ja no dead, Ja no dead, Jah no dead at all. The lyrics were layered. Garvey may have been killed by Empire, but his spirit lived in Rodney's voice, in the music, in the minds of a rising black generation. Burning Spear had become Garvey's ghost, and with each performance, each chant, each deep reverberating breath, he made that ghost louder. Dread at the front line. By the late 1970s, Burning Spear had solidified his identity as reggae's militant mystic, where other artists veered toward romance, pop, or crossover success. Rodney dug deeper into the roots, both spiritual and historical. His 1978 album, Hail H.I.M., was a spiritual elevation of Haile Selassie d'Aquirms, the deified emperor of Ethiopia, revered by Rastafarians as divine. But even here, Rodney remained subversive. He refused to romanticize suffering or sanitize spirituality. Follow Marcus Garvey. Don't go astray. In that line, Selassie is mentioned only to redirect praise back to Garvey, the true philosopher king in Rodney's eyes. By now, the crowds following him were growing. But it wasn't just about the music. It was about the message. They weren't fans. They were disciples. International Resistance Europe came calling. So did Africa. The U.S. booked him in New York, California, and Atlanta. Burning Spear performed everywhere, from small community centers to massive festivals. But even in these foreign cities, his message never softened. He refused to tailor his speeches. He refused to change his dialect. He refused to pretend the wounds of slavery were closed. In France, his concerts were seen as acts of African resistance. In South Africa, his songs became underground anthems for anti-apartheid rebels. But even as his influence spread, Burning Spear remained deliberately underground. He turned down major label offers. He declined commercial endorsements. He knew the world wanted his sound, but not his truth. And he refused to let one be sold without the other. The mission at home. Back in Jamaica, Rodney's influence was complex. Unlike Marley, who became a national icon, Rodney's militancy often made him controversial. Government agencies watched him. Promoters avoided him. He didn't sing about no woman, no cry. He sang about colonial lies, and that made him dangerous. Still, he wasn't afraid. He'd walk through Kingston barefoot, dreadlocks wrapped, calmly chanting Garvey's teachings to anyone who'd listen. "I am not a star," he told one interviewer. "I am a messenger, a teacher, that is all." To Rodney, reggae wasn't the revolution. It was just the delivery system. The revolution was internal, philosophical, ancestral, a family of fire, Sonia Rodney's role. Behind every prophet, there is someone who tends the fire. For Winston Rodney, that person is his wife, Sonia Rodney, his partner, manager, co-producer, and spiritual mirror. She wasn't just a businesswoman behind Burning Music, she was its soul keeper. Together they ensured that every album, every tour, every poster carried not just art, but integrity. They were a unit of resistance, a marriage forged not in comfort, but in shared purpose. And while industry legends crumbled our soul, out, the Rodneys stood firm. The new generation. Is anyone listening? By the late 80s and early 90s, reggae was shifting. Dancehall was exploding. Lyrics turned to party themes, fashion, and flash. The fire was dimming. But Rodney refused to follow the trend. He released People of the World and Mistress Music, albums that spoke about modern colonization, cultural betrayal, and spiritual numbness. Critics called him out of touch. Fans called him a prophet. He didn't care what either thought. His question was simpler. Are they listening? The Grammy years and unwanted recognition. In 2000, the music industry finally caught up. Burning Spear won the Grammy for Best Reggae Album for Calling Rastafari. In 2009, he won again for Jah Is Real. But the truth, Rodney didn't need the recognition. He barely acknowledged it. To him, a trophy couldn't validate a lifetime of speaking truth. The revolution didn't need awards. It needed courage. The Return of the Spear. By the 2020s, Winston Rodney had slowed, touring less, recording rarely. Then in 2022, something unexpected happened. He returned. At nearly 80 years old, Burning Spear stepped onto the stage at Spain's Rotterdam Sunsplash, and later aboard the Welcome to Jamrock cruise. To fans, it was a miracle. To him, it was unfinished business. "I never left," he said backstage. "I was always chanting." And when he stepped to the mic, barefoot as ever, and chanted "Slavery Days Again," the crowd didn't just cheer, they remembered. Conclusion: the movement rises. Marcus Garvey wasn't just an album. It was an altar, a confrontation, a ghost. That ghost still walks through every song Rodney ever recorded. It echoes in the bass. It lives in the drums. It waits in the silence between each lyric. Burning Spear didn't just preserve Garvey's teachings. He embodied them. And in doing so, he sparked a movement that outlived critics, trends, and borders. Rodney never wanted to be famous. He wanted to be faithful. And because of that, his message didn't just survive. It caught fire. Chapter 3: Legacy of the Fire. How Burning Spear refused to die out history tends to silence the prophets it once feared. Once their chants fade, their images softened, their message repackaged for comfort. But what happens when a prophet refuses to die out, when the flame they lit still scorches even decades later? Winston Rodney didn't vanish into reggae history. He resisted it. He didn't become a museum piece. He became a mirror, one that reflects not just Jamaica's soul, but the world's. As his dreadlocks grayed and his gait slowed, the world expected him to go quiet. He didn't. He just got louder in silence. Burning Music, a label built on defiance. In a landscape where most artists chase labels, Rodney built his own, Burning Music Records. Not as a vanity project, but as a spiritual fortress. This wasn't just about owning masters. It was about owning meaning. Burning Music wasn't just a label. It was a vow. A vow that no one would remix his message. That no song would be repackaged for the sake of charts. That his mission, preserving and preaching Garvey's vision, would not be colonized. With his wife Sonia Rodney managing the business and co-producing his work, Winston created a model that future generations of reggae artists would look to as proof that you could be independent, uncompromising, and unstoppable. The fire wasn't just in the music. It was in the model. The fire goes global. By the 2000s, Burning Spear had played every major reggae festival on the planet, often headlining with no hit on the radio, no label backing, no industry campaign, just word of mouth, truth, and legacy. From New York Central Park to Glastonbury, from Montreal to South Africa, Spear's performances became sacred gatherings. No pyrotechnics, no dancers, no gimmicks, just a barefoot man in a linen tunic with a mic in one hand and Garvey in the other. And audiences wept, danced, knelt, not because they were entertained, but because they were remembered. What the world tried to forget Rodney's music didn't age. It unfolded. Tracks like Columbus, Social Living, and Postman became more relevant with each new wave of colonial aftermath. When police violence exploded across the U.S., when immigrant children were locked in cages, when statues of slave traders were finally torn down, Burning Spear's lyrics already had the answers. Down in Jamaica, they got lots of roots, but Babylon want to cut them down. Where is the justice for the children of Marcus? Don't forget your past, else you can't know your future. To listen to Burning Spear wasn't to escape reality. It was to face it fully, and in doing so, reclaim the memory that power tries to erase. The modern era, 2020s and beyond. In 2022, after a long hiatus, Winston Rodney returned to the stage. First at the Rotterdam Sunsplash Festival in Spain, and then on the Welcome to Jamrock cruise. He was nearly 80. The beard was white. The movements were slower. But the voice, unchanged, unyielding, unapologetic. younger artists called his return spiritual. Reggae forums flooded with posts. It was like watching history breathe. Spear isn't music, he's memory. He doesn't perform, he transmits. Rodney stood center stage, barefoot, as always. The band behind him, minimal but sharp. No fancy lighting, just fire. And when he sang Marcus Garvey again, his voice cracked, not from weakness, but from weight. The weight of history, the weight of truth, the weight of still being one of the last warriors standing. Why he never sold out, while contemporaries accepted brand deals, crossover collaborations, and legacy projects funded by major platforms, Rodney turned it all down. He didn't want a Netflix biopic. He didn't want to be rebranded. He didn't want to be edited, because his work was already complete. Each track a chapter, each performance a ritual, each album a record not just of music, but of resistance. To sell it was to dilute it, to brand it was to bury it, and so he waited, quiet, resolute, until the world was ready to listen again. The Children of the Spear, Burning Spear's legacy, doesn't live in radio play. It lives in the artists, organizers, and thinkers who carry his message, not just his melodies. From roots revivalists like Protoja and Chronix, to Pan-African educators across Ghana and Nigeria, to Black Lives Matter organizers chanting Garvey Lives in Ferguson and London. The spirit of Spear lives on. His lyrics are studied in college courses. His albums are smuggled into authoritarian regimes. His chants are sampled in documentaries about genocide, slavery, and resistance. He may not trend on Spotify, but he never stopped trending in the hearts of the awakened. What makes him dangerous still, in a world now drunk on content, dopamine, and algorithms?